Yeah. Hi, I'm David Solomonoff. I'm the president of the Internet Society of New York, and today we're having a symposium here at the anniversary of the 25th anniversary of the divestiture of AT&T to consider directions in telecom policy, what the result of the divestiture has been, and future directions and ways to different direct policy directions in terms of making telecommunication services and broadband services more accessible. Thank you.
I'm going to play the video for you without the sound. And I'll try to fake the words. Hi, welcome to the show. Right now, Singular has just changed its name from...
That's it?
Pause.
Please hold. But now, Singular has gone from Bell South and SBC, from Southwestern Bell to Ameritech, it's from Illinois Bell, Lindemann Bell, Ohio Bell, that was a quiz, and now everyone's called AT&T. And AT&T Wireless has changed its name from Singular to AT&T, but went back to SBC, and now it's AT&T. And then Bell South merged with AT&T, but Bell South is no longer part of AT&T, so AT&T and Singular is now no longer Singular, but it's AT&T. And then Singular changed its name, but now, here's what the Bell system currently looks like, before the breakup. And here's what it is today. So, for all of you sports fans out there, please watch Colbert Report every night at 11:30. Thank you very much. I knew I should have watched it more times. Okay. So I'd like to start my speech, which should only last for 15 minutes. It's been timed. Uh-oh.
Open the other one.
Plus technical difficulties.
Open the other one. Please hold. Okay. We've worked this out to a finely honed presentation. Dun, 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 dun. Thank you very much. Slideshow. Okay, slideshow. Here we go. View show. Hi, my name is Bruce Kushnick. I'm from New Networks Institute. I'm also the chairman of Teletruth and a founding member of Open Infrastructure Alliance. And tonight, we're going to be talking about, has divestiture worked? A 25-year assessment of the breakup of AT&T. But the real question is, how does America get 1 gigabit open, ubiquitous telecommunications and broadband infrastructure? Because what we're going to be talking today about is not just the history, but also the current situation and what we believe is some of the problems that have to be solved, which are not being solved by the stimulus package. Our question is how do we get open, ubiquitous telecommunications broadband? Now, Ma Bell had 1 million employees. She owned the hardware and the networks. She owned the phones in the homes. She owned 22 local phone companies, including New York Telephone. She owned AT&T long-distance lines. She owned Bell Labs. But local service was regulated. It was basically, because it was a monopoly, they said that the price should be fair and reasonable. Fair and reasonable meant that basically if you make too much money, you give it back because, essentially, you're a monopoly and you have control over the networks. But long-distance wasn't regulated. But life was simple in 1980. Local service was a bundled service. It came with the phone. It came with the wire in the home. This bill, by the way, is my Aunt Ethel's bill from 1980. And it was a bundled service. It came with measured service, a $4 call allowance. It came with 6 free directory calls. And in New Jersey, where Tom lives, in New Jersey, Bell, it was $8. And it came with not only the wire and the telephone, but unlimited local service and unlimited directory assistance. But long distance was expensive. A 1 minute call to Vero Beach it was 52 cents. A call to France was $6. And a 3 minute call to Cambridge, Massachusetts at night was 41 cents. So Judge Harold Green, in a civil suit, which you'll be hearing a lot more about, broke up Ma Bell and basically said AT&T would get the long distance markets, the manufacturing business, and Bell Labs, while the seven regional Bell companies, which were created, would get the 22 local monopolies, would get all the cell phone licenses in their territories, and would get directory publishing. Not a bad deal. So here's what the world looked like in 1984. We have Pacific Bell and U.S. West. U.S. West has a very large mass, but it has Wyoming and Utah. On the East Coast, it was 9X and Bell Atlantic, Bell South, Southwestern Bell on the bottom, and Ameritech in the Midwest. The Bell companies, Judge Green made a smart decision. It said we should restrict the company's ability to go into long distance, manufacturing, customer premises, information services, and cable services because they would have undue monopoly power and would be able to harm competitors. So what did the baby Bells want for the first decade? They wanted money and they wanted to be like Ma Bell. It was shareholders first because right after 1984, the Bells cried poor babies and said wanted immediate rate increases. They filed to get rid of every restriction and pitched constant deregulation everywhere. They were buying up everything from furniture stores and computer leasing to international telecommunications. And they all wanted to go into long distance, just like Ma Bell. At the same time, 1986, Southwestern Bell was talking about a wondrous new broadband technology called ISDN. A decade later, it was called It Still Does Nothing. ISDN would revolutionize day-to-day communications of simultaneous transmission of voice and data and images. It was used for video text and teleconferencing. Pac Bell in 1987 said, we're preparing California to compete in the 21st global economy. In the 1990s, we have the information superhighway, the video dial tone, we have the internet, we have the Telecommunications Act of 1996, and the merger craze. While Vice President then Al Gore may not have invented the internet, he definitely was the one who proselytized about the information superhighway, which was supposed to be a fiber optic, totally open, ubiquitous, and incredibly fast network that basically was supposed to be here tomorrow. Or actually, according to Time Magazine, in April 1993, it's coming soon to your TV screen. And the Bell companies basically hyped everyone. For example, in California, this is a page from the California Pacific Bell California Factbook 1994, which shows that the year 2000, San Francisco, Los Angeles, San Diego, and Orange County should have been rewired with fiber optic services. And in New Jersey, now let me explain how this went. In every state, the company said, we're poor babies, we want to build these networks, please give us some more money, get rid of all regulations that guard our profits, we want to make as much as we can, and we'll use that money to go out and build these networks. So from the 1993 state law from New Jersey Bell, by the year 2010, which is on the over there, it says essentially that they would have 100% finished by the year 2010, and they'd be delivering 45 megabit services capable of high definition video in both directions. And they got between $5 and $7 billion to do this. But before I talked about what happened with broadband, let's talk about the Telecommunications Act, 1996. It was deregulation for the last mile. It was going to bring lower prices through competition. It was going to allow internet providers to do line sharing for DSL. It was going to allow AT&T and MCI to compete in local markets. And bottom line was, if the networks were open, the Bells can go into long distance. The next thing that happened was merger mania. AT&T ended up, which was Southwestern Bell to start, bought Pac Bell, SNET, Ameritech, AT&T, and Bell South. Verizon bought Bell Atlantic, 9X. GTE, MCI, and Altel. So the world really looks like this today, which is three big Bells, and they don't compete with each other for wireline services or broadband, except for wireless services. So let me give you a couple of the statistics for the last 25 years very quickly. First, revenues did great. The companies are worth $234 billion, up from $73 billion, which is a 220% increase since 1984. Construction budgets. In the beginning, they used to spend 20 to 25% of their revenues on construction. By the year 2000, it was down to 14%. If they had just continued on the construction budgets, they would have spent an additional $58 to $161 billion. And they over-depreciated by $100 billion to about $371 billion, i.e., when they write off in 1984, depreciation was 65% of construction budgets. By the year 2001, it was 112%, meaning that they were writing off more than they were putting into the ground. And employees, there used to be a lot more employees. There were 680,000 employees of the seven Bell companies in 1984, and then there currently are 491,000 total companies for AT&T, Verizon, and Quest. But if you look at this line, you see the giant discrepancy. The employees for the staff for the wireline services went down about 70%. And they made a lot of money through these alternative regulation plans, meaning get rid of regulation to build the networks. In 1992, they were making 15% of return on equity. In 1995, through the rest of the decade, they were making between 20 and 25%. They doubled the profits that they were making by claiming that there would be networks. So what happened was, for broadband, from 1992 to about 2009, we should have 117 million households wired. We currently have 3.2 million TV upgraded homes for U-verse and Fios. They collected about $300 billion for broadband, which was never put into the ground, and we believe that it cost about $7 trillion to the economy. I like this graphic. And by the way, DSL was a bait and switch. In 1992, the speed of broadband, which I showed you, was 45 megabits in both directions. In 1998, ADSL was rolled out as an afterthought over the old copper wiring. And in 1998, the FCC proclaimed that broadband was only 200K just to keep the number of broadband accounts alive. So what happened to competition? Well, there was a big jump. There was 17 million lines had competition by 2004. And then the FCC made a decision to get rid of competitors. So we have now only 6.8 million lines that are competitive, and most of those are like AT&T and MCI leftovers. There was a giant rise and fall of independent internet providers. From 1997 through 2000, it grew to 9,395 independent companies. At the end of 2005, this is census data, was 2,437 ISPs, and we believe that number is less now. Local service, that service that I showed you in 1980, went up 524% since 1980. Poor Aunt Ethel. Directory assistance is no longer free. It's now $1.50 for call counting taxes. They added the FCC line charge, and every charge went up on the phone bill. By the way, this is based on phone bills from 1980 and phone bills from 2008. And AT&T's basic rate is now 42 cents a minute. In a study we're releasing on Monday, it turns out that the average cost of a long-distance call in San Diego, California, came out to 55 cents a minute when you include all the taxes, surcharges, and other fees. So what happened was is the cost of long-distance is actually more than it was in 1980, before the breakup. And we all hear about how phone bills are totally unreadable and have a mess. So I consider this whole problem not just the company's fault, but what I call the irregulators. The financial services market isn't the only regulatory failure that we found. AT&T and Verizon have been able to have the FCC rewrite the Telecom Act and remove competition. The FCC's data is so flawed that they didn't notice we were 15th in the world in broadband. And the state commissions just failed to enforce the basic commitments, and there was a lack of accountability. So the Bell companies were prohibited in 1984 from all these services. They're currently allowed into all of them today. And so one of the questions we're trying to bring up with the conference is how do we reopen the networks? How do we bring back competition? Which should lower prices? Which should bring more innovative services? Our goal here is to ask also, how do you follow all the money, the $300 billion that was collected? We should be sitting here considering whether there should be a second divestiture and we should really open up the networks. We should demand accurate data and enforcement from all the government agencies. And we should stop corporate astroturfing corporate lobbying groups. Right now, AstroTurf from the patent and Skunk Works. Right now, a lot of groups will say, hey, you know, everything is fine and we should be working together with the phone companies. Unfortunately, the phone companies have paid a lot of AstroTurf groups to basically write reports about how rosy everything should be from their perspective. So Teletruth is about to release a 25th anniversary report next week. If you have any questions, we'll be answering them at the end of this panel. I want to thank everybody for being here personally. I want to thank Evan Korth for helping to put this together from NYU and the rest of the Jolly for the videotape and Lou. And bottom line is you're going to have a great, great series of speakers, and I'm looking forward myself to hearing what everybody has to say. Thank you.
All right, I'm Dean Landsman. I have a company called Landsman Communications Group. This is Tom Alabone from LTC Consulting. And we're here to talk about how this affects the customers, the consumers, those real people out there for their costs of having a phone. Now, if you think back to 25 years ago, it was Ma Bell, it was the phone company, it was just the way things were. But then came 1984, this auspicious year. Now, you know, we all remember Orwell. It's amazing that this happened, in the Orwellian time. And, You know, if you think about how the phone companies are allowed to do data, and I might add our president voted so that, you know, AT&T can tell them everything about you. You are being watched. 84 is an incredibly auspicious year. Why is that not working? There we go. Oops, backwards, not forwards. There we go. There was one phone company, local long distance, one monthly bill. Remember, if you wanted an extension, you had to call Ma Bell. It was really, you needed permission. Or if you were like a savvy guy, you could do it yourself. But pray the phone man might not see it if he came to do anything. You had line charges, whatever that meant. And you had Ma Bell, as Bruce put it, this very maternal, motherly thing. You could trust your mother. Now, I want to talk about long distance, and I have a real interest in this. Way back then, if you wanted to call somebody, say, in Chicago, it might cost 25 cents a minute. And it was, don't interrupt. You know, speak fast. This is expensive. And, you know, if someone's on a call and they're like, shh, long distance. Long distance was this incredible thing. Now, when I came into telecom, kind of by accident, one of the things I began doing was aggregating long-distance services and selling long-distance. I can tell you that right now, I still do some of this work. I can sell New York, Ladder 132, for 0.0025 per minute. That's, you know, a quarter of a cent per minute. But, as Bruce pointed out to you, San Diego, you want to call New York, it's what, 40-some-odd cents?
55
cents. So a quarter of a cent to a company doing significant volume. Now it's 55 cents. Think of the profit. Think of about how that's really helped the consumer in 25 years. To me, that's like, you know, a horror, and our administration should be doing something about that. Now I also want to talk about local. You have to be old enough to remember this stuff. Now people sell the all-you-can-eat. A lot of the cable companies sell all-you-can-eat. Well, remember unlimited? Hey, we got unlimited. We can call anywhere. Well, you couldn't. You could only call on your LATA, but they didn't explain that to you. You couldn't call sometimes 8 miles away because it wasn't in your LATA, but they didn't explain that. Back to that bill that Bruce showed you, but no one could read that bill. Fact is, now, if you want to call, if I live in Rockland County, you in New York want to call me in Rockland County. If you're in LATA, well, actually, I'm still LATA 132, but it's a more expensive call to call local or to call intrastate. You want to call Albany from New York, it's like 9 cents a minute. But you get a decent long distance plan, you buy it from one of my clients, and it's 3 cents a minute. Why is it 3 cents a minute to call San Diego and 9 cents a minute to call Albany? Is it a distance charge? No, if you'll pardon my French, it's a bullshit charge. Now came the breakup. We had a zillion long distance companies. I didn't know what Bruce's speech would be, but we covered ISDN. Long distance got cheap, local got expensive, but as I say, it's still a secret. Now we get to Tom, who's being very polite while I talk. There are many other charges. Now, Tom and I went over this, and I'm going to hand it to you, Tom. Why don't you talk about these in order?
Yeah. By the way, I'm Tom Alabone, president of LTC Consulting. I bring a unique perspective, I think, to the group this evening. For my living, I'm basically a forensic telecommunications auditor. So I dissect phone bills for a living, and I spend a lot of time in front of customers, in particular small businesses, to try to get within, you know, into their heads to understand exactly what they think they bought. And the first slide here, under billing irregularities, actually are examples of some interesting cases that I uncovered probably back around 1989 when I started doing this. The situation with the small home heating oil company was kind of a unique situation. The company was your typical home heating company located in New Jersey, out by the shore area. They had a telephone answering service. They had a connection to the answering service. What we discovered was the answering service hadn't existed for a number of years. It had gone out of business, but the customer continued to pay for the connection to the answering service. Well, then the customer decided to close down the office of the bill that I was auditing, and that line was converted to something called a foreign exchange line. Well, the foreign exchange line was then connected to the answering service that didn't exist. Okay, so the foreign exchange line ended up being changed to a remote call forwarding number, but the connection to the answering service still existed, okay? And the remote call forwarding number then pointed to a new office that the customer had moved to, and the line in question had the ability to handle three simultaneous calls, but the destination number that received the calls only had one line. So therefore, they couldn't use two of the lines. So getting back to the answering service again. So now the answering service is still connected to the foreign exchange line, which does not exist. It's being converted to an RCF line. Okay, and to make matters even worse, the billing system uses a unique language in the old Bell system called USOC code, USOC. And the order was off by a letter. And instead of charging the non-existent circuit to the non-existent answering service at $30 a month, it was billing $300 a month. So the billing errors just kept cascading and cascading. And these things just grew with the customer. The situation in Princeton was really fascinating because it was a situation where the customer in Princeton was actually electronically wiretapped to a totally different company in a different city 20 miles away. It was done through programming at the central office line equipment. I won't go into more details than that. But it was kind of interesting because the investigation showed that this other company, which had no relationship with the company in Princeton, they had seven lines in their system, and lines 1, 3, and 5 were actually wiretapped to the other company, so they were sending their bills to the wrong company. District of Columbia is kind of fascinating because the district decided to undertake its own audit, and lo and behold, they couldn't find about a little over 11,000 lines. Okay, many of the lines did not exist. They had been disconnected. They belonged to other companies. Along with that audit, there were also a bunch of special circuits for various applications. And I believe the final number ended up being close to 1,000 special circuits did not exist. It cost the district almost $10 million, okay, in overcharges and fees. And by the way, because of the way they handled that investigation, they did remove the services and they fixed their system going forward, but they never got the $10 million back. They should have talked to me. I would have got it back for them.
And that's how we get to Tom to the rescue. Now, what's really interesting, and I'm kind of going to give you the end before I give you the beginning here. When Tom and I were putting this together, and I must apologize, my Verizon DSL decided to have a hiccup today, and I couldn't get much past here, and so I bring you half a presentation, but we can do the rest without the PowerPoint. But if you have a complaint, and Tom will go kind of point by point on the complaint, you know, it's tariff versus no more tariff, and who are the consumers, and is this to the benefit of the consumer? Were they supposed to gain something from this breakup? The fact of the matter is, they can't gain it. And I won't talk about this because this is Tom's real area of expertise, but you should explain why this is, why the customer has really gotten screwed.
Yeah, it's been a strange journey, and going from the world of tariffs, where it's heavily regulated, there's a lot of consumer protection, to the world of de-tariffs, which is actually the world of contract law. And the typical average consumer and small business person really has not been educated enough or equipped to understand that difference. Okay, it's very important to understand the fine print. It will get you every time and get you in trouble. Okay, and many of these, when the tariffs went the way of the dinosaur, and we're now under contract law, there are service agreements. Okay, and within these service agreements, there are some really very anti-consumer fine print, and I can just give you a couple of examples. Okay, of what are things to be concerned about. Okay. The contracts are obviously one-sided, as I just mentioned, but I'll give you an example of some typical language. By paying your phone bill, you deem all charges are correct. The average phone bill in America, nobody can decipher it. Okay, rocket scientists, brain surgeons, they can't figure it out. In fact, the past two chairmen of the FCC admitted at the National Press Club that they couldn't answer basic questions about their own phone bills when their wives asked them, what is this, you know, charge all about? So it's not you, okay? It's the system. You have 30 days to dispute a charge, okay? Obviously, it flies in the face of a lot of consumer protection laws, and they all vary from state to state. By using the service, you agree to all terms and conditions. You've got to read the fine print. If you don't read that fine print, you bought the ranch, unfortunately. You agree to binding arbitration with full and non-disclosure. Okay, you want to really think about that. Okay, if you even have a choice, and quite frankly, unfortunately, the language in these agreements is so one-sided that they really are non-negotiable,
I need to interrupt for the sake of time, but the real coup d'etat is that, let's say you discover something wrong with your bill. You bring it to their attention, and they say, oh yeah, that's wrong. You've been overcharged, but that's now a repair issue, not a billing issue, so we'll just keep your money. And this is how they operate. So basically, they have a license to steal, with beautiful language. Now, rather than run overtime and talk about a whole bunch of other stuff, we were going to do a back and forth, which if there's a break, we can do because it's our little act. And if you want to get a phone now, if you want to get a phone line, or God forbid you want internet access, basically, they'll make sure to sell you what you don't want, sell you what you don't need, charge you more than they said they would in order to be your phone company. Thank you.
Hi, I'm Ken Levy, and I don't have a PowerPoint. I'm a late addition. I'm a telecom lawyer, and I was at the FCC during the breakup. I was there from 77 to 85, and it was an exciting time. When I got there, you know, you kind of immediately knew that you were being noticed by AT&T. And, you know, within a few days, an AT&T guy would come to your office and introduce himself and offer to help you with anything that you needed, and you got the distinct impression he would manage your career. And if you did everything right, you know, you could do pretty well. They called it the age of continuing surveillance. That was a symbiotic relationship between AT&T and the FCC at the time. And when I got there, there was a lot of resentment because this court, the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, had issued these decisions called ExecuNet, and that had required the FCC to allow MCI to stay into business despite having tried to put it out of business. So there was a tremendous resentment among the staff. There were some people who were public interest minded at the time and tried to do things, but they didn't know to ask the right questions. They were kind of, AT&T would drown them in paper. They would have these trial type hearings where they develop 20,000 page records, MPL, high, low, and then as soon as it was getting close to a finding of unlawfulness, they would come in with a new rate plan, start a new trial type proceeding. After a couple of years, I got to be chief of the legal branch in the tariff division, and I put out a notice that said there'll be no more trial type hearings anymore. Everything will be on paper. We also put out a notice that said, well, you shouldn't go out to lunch or dinner with AT&T and have them pay for it. And eventually that spread all through government. So it was possible to accomplish some things, but it was a real tough environment to work in. Things started to open up when in the late Carter administration, and some of the people came over from Justice, like Phil Verveer, Tom Casey, and started doing the competitive carrier rulemaking, opened the reduced regulation for the non-dominant carriers, designated this new group called Enhanced Service Providers, although I'm not sure anybody really understood what that was or what that could possibly become. And then we started making some progress in the tariff division to eliminate some of the long-term restrictions that AT&T had used to keep competition out and control the market, like restrictions on the resale of Watt service, restrictions on using private lines, it's now called special access, to form telephone service equivalents, MTS Watts equivalents it was called. Prior to divestiture, it would have been heresy to suggest that an 800 number was in the public domain. That was a property of AT&T, and anybody who said otherwise probably never would have been given anything of consequence to work on at the FCC. So then came the announcement of the settlement, and as far as I know, no one at the FCC was aware that was brewing. I mean, you could imagine, but I don't believe AT&T consulted the FCC beforehand. But then we had a lot of work to do, and that work was we had to approve the divestiture in the public interest. And there were all of these arrangements that were internal to the Bell system and AT&T. And they had to be made explicit because they were no longer going to be affiliated. So there were all these rulemakings to do. And then at the same time, the FCC was about to adopt an access charge plan system. And this was a plan that was almost ready when the divestiture came, and it was basically designed by AT&T. And after I left the commission, I heard that the whole LEC industry and AT&T had this order before the FCC adopted it, and they were all reading it. It was a signed reading over Christmas vacation. That was the way it worked in those days. But the good thing was that the divestiture was so destabilizing, you know, from the standpoint of these people who had, you know, had no question that they would have a lifelong career. It was quite an upheaval. And on the government side, there was a lot of, this was the Reagan years, of course, so big business could do no wrong, but there was a lot of consternation. Hey, is this thing really going to work? Is it all going to come tumbling down? And you know, the chairman of the FCC was a pretty fair-minded guy, and he stood up to daily calls from Charlie Brown, the chairman of AT&T at the time, to move this thing along. We were supposed to just kind of lay over and let the thing go in. But we saw when and there was a change of personnel, you know, kind of the people who had developed the access charge plan left, and they thought it was wired to go in, and then you know, some of us were able to undo some of those things. But there were all sorts of anti-competitive provisions, both in the original access charge plan and in the tariffs that they filed. For example, you know, they had very high pre-subscription change charges and elaborate procedures. This is, you had to, it was a procedure if you wanted to switch from AT&T, who was your default interexchange carrier, to a new interexchange carrier. We're talking about long-distance competition. This is before local. Then the original access charges would have applied to wireless, to enhanced service providers. It would have been a permitted access charge, which was like 2 to 6 cents a minute to surf the net. They also, a feature I particularly like was one where they had, they figured out a way to apply double access charges to resellers. So the resellers wouldn't have had much of a chance. So this was the order as it stood with the new bureau chief and the chairman. We were able to work out we told the chairman, you know, do you want to be known as the chairman who gave away the store? And I think we probably averted something similar to what was in the savings and loan, what was going on in the savings and loan area. So we got we convinced the chairman to suspend the tariffs, and the tariffs is where they really work their magic. They were impenetrable, complex. The access charge plan was complex. There's some new things that are being proposed in intercarrier compensation and universal service by the industry that are similarly complex. This is the comfort zone of the big, heavily resourced monopolists. They make it very difficult for anybody to oppose or for regulators to understand. The strategy is to befuddle, bewitch, and obscure the anti-competitive strategies that underlie all of these programs. I'll give you an example. So for example, you know, nobody knew about ISPs in those days. I mean, I found in the old Bell tariffs, there was in these old Bell tariffs that applied in certain areas, and I found out that they had an exemption or a preferential rate for a category that they called composite data service vendors. So I went up to the commission. I said, hey, you know, if you let this thing in, and there were going to be $6 end user charges, divestiture could have been a lot worse. I mean, if you think it's not good, it could have been a lot worse. $6 end user charges. AT&T, even though they were authorized, 10.5%, I think, at the time, they had never earned over 9. And they were going to use the divestiture to up their rate of return through these intercompany flows. So I went up and I said, "Well, we got to be careful about rate shock. Congress was getting concerned about the high end user charges." So I said, and there are all these traditional exemptions that we have to gradually phase in access charges. So we said, what we suggest is that we exempt these enhanced service providers from the access charges, for a temporary period until things settle down. And the commission bought it. They also bought things like a private line surcharge for the leaky PBXs and that heating companies use in New Jersey and things like that. So all those things got in. A lot of them, and we also convinced the commission to require separate subsidiaries for the Bell companies. And that stuck for about 2 years. Because at the time they were getting into all these Hollywood deals, and there was absolutely no Part X, no accounting system in place to separate out the regulated from the unregulated. So, of course, it was a rare blip on the regulatory screen. It was the normal dynamics where the agency serves industry didn't apply because it was so destabilizing. It was actually possible to accomplish something. They did try to close. They came back in, and I had to leave and all that. And they closed the door on a lot of these things. The private line surcharge became optional, the $25 surcharge, things like that, even though they were all upheld in court. Of course, the ESP exemption stuck. A few years later, Chairman Patrick tried to close that one, and even then, in like 87, 88, he was shouted down by the information power group that had, even in those years, had grown large enough that he couldn't do anything with it. So, be wary of these intercarrier compensation plans that are going to develop uniform rates for everybody, and we'll give you this and we'll give the other guy that because there's always something behind it that isn't going to help you out in the end. Thank you. Pleasure.
Hello. I'm Alex Goldman. I worked for ISP Planet from February of 2000 to February of 2009, and I have been asked to cover the history of the regulatory errors of that period. I've been asked to cover the regulatory errors of that period. The past 10 years have been very bad for competition. Really bad, but right now things might seem worse. I think any subject you talk about today, you have to mention the recession. And the recession is bad. I don't know if you saw today, Frontier Communications stock dropped $1, but it started today at $1.50. And so there's a slight possibility that Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine may have no phone company in the future. This is crisis, and crisis can mean good things or bad things. It can mean an opportunity for change, for better or for worse. In January of 2009, The Economist magazine, in an editorial entitled "Paved with Good Intentions," wrote, "Perhaps the biggest risk of all the broadband plans is that the incumbents will exploit the crisis to gain regulatory concessions, limiting competition, and open access to their networks in exchange for promises to invest. This could even help recreate the telecoms monopolies of old." And that's a worldwide comment. That's not just about the... Not just about the United States.
They have the remote controllers.
They heard you say that and turned off your mic.
Yes, they certainly are powerful.
I heard him say it's a disjoint.
Should go back.
Please hold.
Please hold. Now, what's been frustrating for a lot of us gathered here who have been commentators and journalists like Dave Burstein and Bruce Kushnick is that we saw this coming. We saw this years and years and years ago. I remember watching the FCC hearing, Dave, on fiber, and you were the one who stood up at the FCC hearing and said, wait a minute, doesn't this mean that if the telco has a foot of fiber in any loop, that they don't have to share it? And I think the FCC reply was, but yes, but of course we trust the phone company.
Well, we have a new regime now. Let's hope it changes.
We hope it changes. And I think part of the reason we're here is to go over the mistakes of the past and hope that they will not be repeated in the future. There's a complaint process that ISPs could use to challenge bad behavior by the phone company, known as the Section 208 complaint process. In 2003, in FCC docket 02-340, on a footnote, the FCC acknowledged that Earthlink had complained that the Section 208 complaint process is time-consuming and resource-intensive and ignores the practical need to address anti-competitive behavior when it happens. And, of course, the FCC acknowledged that but did nothing to address the problem. What was happening was the ISPs like Earthlink were being asked to spend thousands of dollars on a lawsuit every time a $50 a month customer was unfairly connected to the phone company. And we all knew that all of this was going to happen. We saw it happen again with VoIP. When VoIP arrived, one of the great things about it was that you could take your phone out of your house, have your phone number with you, and move across the country. At ISPCon, we had people who had taken the business phone number of their office in Indiana, brought it to San Jose, and were answering their office phone calls in San Jose. The FCC found a way to prevent that. They said, they called it E911. They said, you can't move your VoIP phone because we have to be able to provide 911 service. And so they also started, to tax it. In 2004, I was interviewing Bruce Kushnick, and he said to me, and I quote, "The Bell phone company's SEC filings don't explain how they built a new business, long distance, essentially for free. That's because the Bell phone companies enjoy the ability to cross-subsidize all of their new businesses. The long-distance companies will be taken apart, and only the Bell and cable companies will survive." Well, that was 2004. He was right. That's what happened. In addition, and this I thought was a pretty inflammatory quote I got note for, and it wasn't widely repeated, and I don't think Jason Talley of Nuvio would like me to repeat it, but I'll repeat it here. He told me about wiretaps. He said, "We could come up with a system that would be more efficient. Currently, law enforcement has to tap a phone call to allow an investigator to listen in. That requires going to a switch. With VoIP, just tell us where to send a copy of the media stream. We could send it to the DOJ in D.C., to FBI headquarters, or to a local FBI field office." And essentially, they did that too, but in an incredibly burdensome way that managed to do irreparable harm to small ISPs. Imagine that it cost a flat fee to comply with CALEA. The flat fee is about $100,000. If you're $1 million a year business, that's going to be a serious burden. If you're one of these $100 billion a year phone companies, you're not even going to notice it. The FCC realized, or claimed to realize, all of these. As clearly as we all knew this was happening, the FCC also knew that it was happening, but didn't do anything about it. You go through these 100, 200, 500 page FCC documents, you can find them actually admitting that all of this was going to happen. And they, page 291 of the FCC Triennial Review of 2003, "Competition is meant to benefit customers and not create obstacles for them." Yeah, that's true. The record shows that customers experiencing service disruptions generally blame their provider, even if the problem is caused by an incumbent. Indeed, Zetel tells us that one glitch or delay in the cutover process for a mass market customer may be enough to convince the customer to go back to the incumbent. The information was there, is there, has always been there. And it just it was astonishing to see over and over and over again the same mistakes. If I had to provide an overarching theme, I would say that there were two overarching problems with regulations: hostility to competition and uncertainty. It was one thing for competition to be faced with a hostile FCC, but a hostile and predictable FCC would have been easier to deal with than what we actually had, which was a hostile and capricious FCC. In addition to regulatory fairness in the future, I think we also hope for a clear policy. And I think, at this point, I believe we will get that from the new FCC.
My name is Mark Cooper. I'm Director of Research at the Consumer Federation of America. I'm also a fellow at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford and at the McGannon Center for Communications Research at Fordham, uptown. I'm going to do something a little different. I made a New Year's resolution to begin every speech this year with the observation that the long experiment with market fundamentalism and its irrational exuberance for deregulation is over. It started symbolically on January 20th, 1981, when Ronald Reagan declared government is the problem, and ended symbolically on October 23rd, 2008, when Alan Greenspan, the leading apostle of deregulation in the financial sector, admitted under cross-examination in the House of Representatives that there was a flaw in his theory. Quote, "Those of us who look to the self-interest of lending institutions to protect shareholder equity, myself included, are in a state of shocked disbelief. I made a mistake in presuming that the self-interest of organizations, specifically banks and others, were such that they were best capable of protecting their own shareholders and their equity in the firm. We in the consumer movement have always believed that the pursuit of private profit is not synonymous with the public good. Greenspan goes us one step farther, suggesting that the pursuit of private profit is not even synonymous with the private good. If the profit motive cannot protect the private interest of equity owners, you can imagine what a mess it makes of the public interest. Now note that Greenspan's admission is not specific to the financial sector, but is a general proposition about economic incentives. So Greenspan's observation undercuts one of the central assumptions of market fundamentalism, the claim that markets tend toward efficient equilibrium, or the efficient market hypothesis. The recent collapse of the economy has also undercut two other central tenets of market fundamentalism, the claim that that government is the problem, what I call the less government, the better hypothesis, and the claim that inequality does not matter, the trickle-down hypothesis. The three central assumptions of market fundamentalism have proven to be fallacies. Now, in the financial sector, the underlying cause of the failure of unregulated markets is a nexus of incentive problems and information problems, conflicts of interest and moral hazard. And you've all read about that in your newspapers. In the real economy, the underlying cause of the failure of unregulated markets is market structure, the persistent and repeated failure of competition, and the abuse and exercise of market power. Left to its own device, the market is plagued by endemic problems that simply make it impossible to do its function of efficiently allocating resources to uses. Economic theory could always envision a more efficient outcome without regulation only by ignoring and downplaying the market failures. and reality could not produce the theoretical outcome because those market flaws always asserted themselves. So my central hypothesis is that we need a new attitude toward market failure that must flow from the collapse of market fundamentalism. It is time to replace the age of irrational exuberance for markets, where regulation was seen to be the ex post cleanup after the occasional market failure, to an understanding that regulation is, in fact, the ex ante prophylaxis against market failure. Now, sometimes the challenge in my New Year's resolution is to make the topic relevant to what I've been asked to speak about. Now, as a consumer advocate, that never dissuades me. But with respect to divestiture, this is, and the internet, this is easy. The logic of divestiture was crystal clear within the framework of what I call pragmatic progressive capitalism, or we talk about as the New Deal. Right? Inject competition into the monopoly structure where it is viable, and continue to regulate where it is not. A simple proposition that actually worked for 75 years. Unfortunately, divestiture occurred at the start of the age of market fundamentalism, and market fundamentalists have no self-control. Since they cannot accept the proposition that the threat of market failure is real, they push deregulation beyond its rational limits. And as in the case of telecommunications and the Telecommunications Act of 1996, they lack the intestinal fortitude, the intellectual honesty, to control monopoly power sufficiently to allow competition to grow. Now, make no mistake about it, and the first time I testified on the 96 Act was 1982. But make no mistake about it, the Telecommunications Act of 1996 linked divestiture and deregulation inextricably. The simple fact of the matter is the 96 Act was pushed by the incumbent local exchange carriers who chafed under the dual yoke of state regulation and the restrictions imposed upon them by federal antitrust regulation. And so the 96 Act was intended to open the door for the local companies to reunify local and long distance. They were supposed to be able to do that upon a showing that their monopoly power in the local exchange had been eroded. Unfortunately, the market fundamentalists in charge confused the slightest hint of entry with workable competition, and they allowed the reconstitution of the monopoly. So regulators, legislators, and courts made a series of critical mistakes if they were actually intending to have competition in telecommunications. Essentially, based upon long experience and empirical evidence, the Department of Justice has a guideline for approving mergers, which essentially concludes that if there are fewer than the equivalent of six equal-sized competitors, a merger is likely to be harmful and ought not to be approved. In the past decade, the standard has been something like anything more than two is okay. And there's a big difference between two and four and what you get in the marketplace. So this lax standard, completely ignoring traditional antitrust practices, was basically built upon an over-reliance on intermodal competition and potential competition, right? Hey, somebody can come in and compete. That must be worth three or four potential competitors. Oh, well, the cable guys will always compete with the telephone guys. But in simple fact of the matter is that the reliance on intermodal competition was intended to obscure the truth that a traditional view of markets would tell you. They were too darn concentrated. The 1996 Act also set in motion an even more dangerous and serious shift in communications policy by fumbling the definition of telecommunications services. The 96 Act opened the door to the repeal of the obligation for non-discriminatory interconnection and carriage that was deemed that has ensured open communications for 100 years. Actually, 2010 is the 100-year anniversary of the Mann Act, in which the obligation of non-discrimination that had been written for railroads in the Interstate Commerce Act was extended to the telecom industry. So the internet is a meta platform that rides atop a communications platform, has massive positive externalities. An open internet is an incredible engine of progress. It's infrastructural in the same sense that banking is infrastructural. We simply cannot tolerate a low-level probability of market failure or a hint of market power because of the tremendous growing potential of this platform. Market fundamentalists make two critical mistakes when they analyze the internet. They underestimate the likelihood of market failure, and they treat the internet like it was just widgets as opposed to an infrastructural platform. They underestimate the probability and the cost of the abuse of market power. Fortunately, market fundamentalists were not in charge in 1968 when the FCC made two magnificent regulatory decisions. And we hear about how bad government is. But in 1968, the FCC decided to, one, allow people to hook devices to the phone network, right? It required AT&T to publish an open standard for customer premise equipment. That's the Carterphone decision. And at the same time, they conducted the first computer inquiries in which they told AT&T that AT&T wanted to treat data in a different way than telecom. They wanted to discriminate, and the FCC said, no, you have to treat data in a non-discriminatory fashion. For 30 years, every bit that traveled over the internet traveled over an open network because of the computer inquiries and arrived at a cable modem certified under Carterphone. Those were the key conditions for the creation of the internet in this country. Unfortunately, in 1996, the Telecom Act came along and sort of scratched its head about all these services, and the FCC, under the most extreme of market fundamentalists, Mike Powell, said, hey, cable telecommunication services is not a telecommunication service. And he said, they're not subject to Title II. I will tell you a little story. I don't know if it's still on the web, but in the famous case of Portland v. AT&T, where we were fighting over whether or not they had to do open access, we called it back then, Portland and AT&T had agreed that they were going to call it a cable service and then argue about whether Portland could regulate a cable service. And the AT&T attorney walked into the room. He went up first. The poor bastard had to go first. And he said, we've agreed that this is a cable service. And the chief judge looked down at him and said, what are you talking about? This is a telecom service. The judge would not accept the premises on which the two parties were trying to carry the case forward. The poor guy didn't have a chance. He was all prepared to argue why the cable service shouldn't be regulated. And once the judge says it's a telecom service, of course, everyone in his right mind knows it has to be regulated. The guy from Portland went second. He had 10 minutes to gather his thoughts. And so therein lies why we won that case. Of course, we kept winning that case until we got to the Supreme Court. And so now we have this mess and all the debate about, where we are. But let's be clear. We abandoned intramodal competition. We failed to promote competition on the platform under the 96 Act, right? We are now left with a cozy duopoly in network access that has essentially escaped from regulation. The duopoly of cable and telephone companies, I like to call it a crummy duopoly, Business Week called it a cozy duopoly. They've basically been allowed to dribble out bandwidth at high prices, each one inching up against the other one, coming nowhere near what other nations in the world get. Attempting to convince them to roll this stuff out faster at a lower price, the FCC started making all kinds of concessions, throwing more money at them. This is the second $200 billion, right? Bruce talked about the first $200 billion, which was the copper part. Now we've got the second $200 billion. So they say, fine, you don't have to run an open system. They abandon the support for unbundling and say, well, so you don't have to unbundle your network. They let them price key access elements, wholesale, local loop, any way they want, right? Absolutely killing competition. So essentially, the free market fundamentalists who don't really believe in competition, they essentially believe in big business, have brought us to a state where we have neither regulation nor competition. Having launched my discussion here with a big sweeping claim, let me finish with one. This is not a debate about capitalism versus socialism, which is what you hear all the time in Washington. This is a debate between a pragmatic, progressive approach to capitalism that was implemented in the U.S. in the New Deal and the radical market fundamentalism that has been the experiment of the last 30 years. Fixing this is not the radical thing. Fixing this, we don't even need a new deal. We just need the old New Deal back. It worked much better. I have a slide in the financial sector in which, if you look at American history, from 1797 until 1933, there was a major financial crisis every 20 years. Of course, unregulated markets do not produce stability. From 1936, when the institutions of prudential regulation in the New Deal were put in place, from 1936 till 1986, there is not one major financial crisis. The record of New Deal prudential regulation is perfect. And then, of course, you get Garne St. Germain and the S&L crisis. In the last 20 years, there has been an average twice as many financial crises as there were before the New Deal. In fact, if you look at the telecom sector, that antiquated relic, the Communications Act of 1934, updated in 1968 by a thoughtful commission, produced a remarkable record of success. And that's all we have to grab on in order to get our minds right to go back to the right policy. Thank you.
Questions? For any of the panelists? Just identify the panelists.
I'll be first.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm talking in half an hour. And Mark knows how much I admire and respect all this thinking. But the question I'm asking everybody in this case is, what do you do if competition isn't going to work? You believe that you're probably going to have a duopoly plus wireless for the next 10 years. And I don't have answers, but I want that. But that's a good question.
Well, for me, the answer is, and I've begun to give up on competition. I'm the guy that used to always haul up on the airline mergers. They say, hey, get the consumer guy, he'll complain about the mergers. And 3 or 4 years ago, I said, you know, competition doesn't work in the airline industry. Airline industry pleases no one, right? Consumers hate it, labor hates it, investors hate it, okay? And the guys in the 30s who designed the regulatory regime were pretty smart guys. They said, you know what? This is an industry that's destructively competitive. And they said, we need a regulatory approach, right? When I say that to all these Congress people who voted for airline, I'm not the witness of choice anymore. They don't want to hear that, right? So my answer is that the logic of divestiture was exactly right. And we have to get back to that. That is, we have to really think hard about where the piece parts are that could be competitive and take a whack at it, right? We never really tried, as you've heard from these other people, okay? Now, there are some things that are not going to work. If I'm not going to have six or more, and you understand nobody dreams of six access lines into the home, right? If I'm not going to have six or more, that access line has to be regulated.
And what do we do then? If we say there are only going to be three, say, one breaking fiber network, what, if they say, I've really been trying to figure this one because I think it's the reality that we're dealing with. I'd be surprised if we get a third wire to the home in New York City, for example. And I can get into that if anybody doesn't see it. So I think competition is going to be weak. So what do we do then? More than just accept regulation, because we know regulation has its problems too, and that doesn't say what the regulator should do. So what do? If we're going to have Verizon and Time Warner and wireless in New York City in 10 years from now?
I fundamentally believe that network neutrality, and I understand that's a demand side issue, and there's lots of supply side folks too who that doesn't solve their problem, right? But a well-designed network neutrality regime, and remember, the Consumer Federation of America were the people who invented the open access debate. We were the first people to petition the FCC in October of 1998 on a TCI merger, AT&T-TCI merger, for network open access conditions, we called it. If we have a good open access condition, okay, in which ISPs have access to a reasonable amount of bandwidth, there will be immense innovation in that space that will discipline the Verizon world. And I'll give you a perfect example. People mentioned ISDN. Why didn't ISDN succeed? Because the Bells didn't want it to succeed because it cannibalized their T1 revenues. Okay? What killed T1? Modems, right? We took the 300 board modem over copper wire and we crammed so much stuff in there with some good technology and some good compression that the competition over that Carter phone device through a computer inquiry network actually disciplined the monopolist. So that's my hope, right? But I need to get sufficient bandwidth so that I can threaten the high-end stuff that Verizon wants to do, right? And now we can debate about how many megs do I have to have available to me. You know, the people I talk to tell me the vast majority of services that consumers will use for decades can be provisioned with a 5-megabit network.
Bullshit.
That's not true.
Okay. Wait, one second. I'm going to take control here. We have one more question from Scott, and then we're going to get to the second panel. So whoever's on the second panel, get ready.
Actually, it's not a question. It's a follow-up to Mark. Let me try to say essentially the same thing, but in a different way.
Well, you're going to say some of this on
the facilities panel. Themselves, they are essential facilities. Yeah. One, maybe two wires. That's all that makes sense to have here. Fiber especially is a natural monopoly. It doesn't make sense to have multiple providers of fiber. So what you do is you regulate the infrastructure providers and you make sure that they have the incentive to be good infrastructure providers and you give them a good regulated return. You regulate them much like you did the telephone companies of old, but you regulate the provision of access and connectivity. And then you open up the network and allow those who do not have market power and cannot have market power to provide their goods and services over.
Well, I just want to say that Scott and a few other people have ideas about how to get there, and that's on the third panel. But before we get to the third panel, we have the second panel. It goes like this.